14. Secrets, Lies, and Audio Tape. Informer 3838 turns witness. 2007 to 2009. Carl Williams was just another bare bum in the jailhouse shower, but he was about to make life very difficult for the woman who was once his trusted lawyer. On the outside, he and Tony Mockbell had boasted such infamy that they were known only by their first names. They also shared an honorific. Carl was Fat Boy, and Tony was, naturally, Fat Tony. They were the headline acts. On the inside, Williams was serving one sentence for murdering Michael Marshall and was awaiting trials for five more charges for ordering the deaths of Lewis, Jason, and Mark Moran, Mark Marlia, and Pasquale Little Pat Barbaro. He was also charged with a failed plot to kill Mario Condello. Looking for ways to reduce a long sentence in prison, Fat Boy put pen to paper. He was yet to get his prison computer, and told tales about an unfortunate trio from back in 2004. Himself, ex-detective Paul Dale, and Nicola Gobbo. Williams was in the back of a prison van when the van turned around and headed back to court on Justice King's orders. Williams had told his lawyers that he was willing to strike a deal. He was prepared to plead guilty to three murders and wanted a minimum sentence of no more than 30 years. This was a turnaround. He had told a court hearing in December 2006 that he would fight the charges. His mother, Barbara, tried to talk him out of making a deal. But Williams wanted one, not just for himself, but also for his father, George, who remained a suspect in the Lewis Moran killing, and for his ex-wife, Roberta. Their marriage had fizzled in early 2007, with the latter confiding to the Herald Sun, "He just wanted me to move on." Williams's statement of April 2007 was aimed at reducing his combined sentence for the murders of Jason and Lewis Moran and Marlia, and conspiracy to murder Condello. The charges for the murders for Mark Moran and Pasquale Barbaro were dropped as part of the deal. In it, Williams described the so-called hillside meeting, when Dale purportedly asked Williams if he was prepared to kill Terry Hodson for him, an allegation Dale has always denied. The statement also named Gobbo as the liaison between him and Dale in the weeks before the Hodsons were killed. A second and third statement, both made in January 2009, would be more detailed. "What am I going to get?" he kept asking his lawyers. One of those lawyers, Sharon Cure, received Williams's draft statement about Dale in a sealed envelope in the hours after it was made. She had an office in Crockett Chambers, a prestigious cradle of leading QCs, as did Nicola Gobbo. Barristers had resisted when Con Heliotis QC, the Golden Greek, offered Gobbo an office in the Chambers the year before. Gobbo's reputation had preceded her, in part because Carl Williams had fueled gossip that she was a dog. Cure had Williams' statement in her office for an hour, perhaps two. She had not had time to read it before Detective Sergeant Stuart Bateson arrived. According to Cure, Bateson closed the door behind him and asked her to hand over the sealed envelope. She complied. Was Bateson seeking to protect Gobbo's alleged role as a go-between for Williams and Dale from being revealed? Cure would not read the statement until the 2019 to 2020 Royal Commission. Fat Boy was sentenced on the 7th of May 2007. Justice Betty King, donning her signature red glasses, had received Williams's sealed statement 10 days earlier. The statement didn't help. Williams copped a minimum sentence of 35 years for the extra three murder and murder conspiracy charges. He was 36 and doomed to remain in prison until 2042. It shouldn't have surprised him. Already sentenced to 21 years for the Marshall killing, he got an extra 14 years for ordering the two public executions of Lewis and Jason Moran, and for the deathly torture of Marlia. Charges for the deaths of Pasquale Barbaro and Mark Moran were dropped in the plea deal Williams negotiated with prosecutors. Williams's pen pal girlfriend, mum and dad, were at the sentencing. So was Judy Moran, the matriarch of brothers Mark and Jason. Justice King labelled the defendant as arrogant, almost supercilious. Williams had acted as judge, jury and executioner. As she pronounced her sentence, Williams was no longer winking at his family through the perspex encasing the witness box.
"Ah, get fucked," he said, announcing that he had expected nothing less of King.
Barbara joined in, yelling at Justice King,
"You are a puppet for corruption. You're a puppet of piranha. You don't deserve your wig and your gown."
Judy Moran was disappointed too, that Williams was still breathing. Williams's barristers, David Ross and Cure, withered under a tirade of Williams's abuse after his courtroom exit. Cure didn't represent Fatboy ever again. Piranha detectives rejoiced. Many of them gathered in their matching striped ties to hear a judge condemn the gangland kingpin to be locked up until he was 71. Piranha detectives could bask in the satisfaction of having outmaneuvered such a societal menace. Assistant Commissioner Overland summed up the public reaction. "Carl Williams is not a B-grade actor. He is actually a serious criminal." Gloating piranha detectives downed pints at a pub near Melbourne's Supreme Court. They spotted Gobbo at a nearby bar and sent over a bottle of champagne. Journalists noticed Gobbo's displeasure at receiving the bubbly. They thought the detectives were signalling "up yours" to a Williams lawyer and acolyte. How could they know police were actually thanking Gobbo for her secret contribution to the conviction of gangland's biggest name? A bottle of bubbly wasn't going to give Gobbo's secret away, but Carl Williams just might. He launched an appeal against his sentence in the Supreme Court 10 days after Justice King's condemnation. Williams's decision to plead guilty had freed Gobbo from possible exposure in a courtroom trial, but she was still meddling, terrified that legal documents subpoenaed by Williams's legal team would reveal her conflicted roles. Gobbo needed to know. She still denies the following version of events, which labels her actions as criminal, but it is supported by police notes from the time. On Saturday the 24th of June 2007, when Crockett Chambers was deserted, Gobbo made her way up to the 7th floor, where she and Cure both worked, and entered Cure's office. She might have used a master key that sat in an electrical cupboard near the floor's kitchen. Cure says she might have left her office unlocked. Cure no longer represented Williams, but she had kept notes relating to his case. Gobbo rifled through them, finding phone records that showed the frequent calls between the European and Gobbo. Royal Commission lawyers would call Gobbo's snooping burglary. The Herald Sun, Gobbogate. Cure now believes that Gobbo was motivated by self-preservation. Cure had worked on the Williams case that Justice King had ruled Gobbo could not be involved in. Cure thinks Gobbo wanted to find out what she knew. "I couldn't stand her," Cure says. "I never trusted her." Gobbo was furious that police had allowed the release of the phone records and other documents to Cure. She was also incensed by Williams's statement against her and Paul Dale. She had obtained copies of these. It's unclear how and when. Why wasn't she warned, she wanted to know, that Williams had made up shit about her links to Dale? She was growing more and more contemptuous of her handlers. The relationship was turning sour. The hunter was now the haunted. Soon, Gobbo had better reasons to feel riled. She was about to be drawn into the Hodson murder investigation once more. Under homicide detective Charlie Bezina, the case had spluttered and stalled. It finally exploded afresh with the new allegations from Williams. As a response to Williams's statement, Assistant Commissioner Overland had launched the Petra Task Force in April to reinvestigate the deaths. He had always wanted a conviction. But he was also mindful of bad publicity about corrupt cops in the aftermath of the 2004 killings. Bazina and his homicide colleagues had been denied vital information possessed by Piranha. The Petra Task Force grew to be just as secretive. Armed with Williams's statement, Petra's elite investigators became convinced that Paul Dale was guilty of murder, and Nicola Gobbo would be compelled to become a witness against him. Petra investigators interviewed more than 200 people of interest, including Gobbo. Detective Sergeant Sol Solomon and Detective Senior Constable Cameron Davey wanted to know about her close connections to the Hodsons in 2003 and 2004, but this witness was to be treated unlike any other in Solomon's long career. Gobbo was not to be contacted directly. Instead, Solomon and Davey had to submit written questions to be passed up the chain of police command. Such conditions were unheard of. Homicide detectives have always commanded unfettered access to any witness or person of interest. Lump it, Solomon was told, without explanation. Follow the process or don't talk to Gobbo at all. He says he didn't know that Gobbo was a registered informer until it was revealed in the media. Solomon and Davey interviewed Gobbo four times in 2008. They raised her use of burner phones in 2004 to speak to Paul Dale and Adam Ahmed, the man who ran the Oakley drug house burgled by Terry Hodson and David Michel in 2003. Petra had teased out the phone connections, and Gobbo's use of burner phones appeared untoward. Fear probably drove Gobbo's choice to cooperate. Usually, she liked to show off her insider knowledge, but she was rightly uneasy about the Hodson case. She must have known how unethical her past behaviour would appear in the glare. There was the other side, too, as constant as her need to protect herself. Gobbo liked assisting police, whether as an informer, meddler, or de facto undercover operative. Gobbo was a person of interest to Petra, but she was about to become an undercover spy for Petra too. In mid-2008, she agreed to a highly improper sting. Her old client, Andrew Hodson, had long been a suspect in his parents' deaths. He failed a lie detector test in early 2008, and his acrimony towards his father was well known. Father and son fell out after Andrew was shown proof of Terry Hodson's informing by Tony Mockbell in 2002. Investigators felt that Andrew would never hurt his mother, but some wondered whether he had provided information, including the layout of the house, to someone else who did. Petra decided that Hodson should be shaken up to shake out his knowledge. Hodson told Darsley and Carlyon he was picked up at an eastern suburbs shopping centre and taken to a nearby police station. Over several hours of questioning, Hodson, who was drunk at the time, denied any knowledge of his parents' murders. Officers told him he couldn't leave the room until he gave up information. "I can't give you the answer," he told them. "I had nothing to do with it." Needing help, Andrew's wife Cindy rang his lawyer, Nicola Gobbo. Gobbo told her to bring Andrew down for a chat. Gobbo was the sting. The police were provoking Andrew Hodson so he would go to Gobbo, who would wear a wire to record her confidential conversation with him. The hope was that Hodson would be looser with his lawyer if he thought his words were private. The scheme lurched its participants into criminal realms, clearly breaching legal professional privilege. Gobbo and Petra sought to incriminate Hodson out of his own mouth, not in a police interview, but in a confidential lawyer-client discussion. The sting failed. Hodson did not go to Gobbo for advice because he felt he did not need to unless police charged him. Beforehand, Gobbo's SDU handlers had warned her not to participate under threat of deregistration. "But if you do record Andrew Hodson," they told her, "give us the tape, not Petra." Victoria Police, like every police force, has always been riddled with Byzantine politics, but secretiveness had begun to flourish at the expense of crime-solving in a climate of mistrust. So much for solving murders. Soon Gobbo volunteered herself for another sting that had a very different outcome. Solomon was at home when Gobbo rang him unexpectedly on Sunday the 30th of November 2008. She was meeting Dale, she told the detective. Would he like her to record him? Solomon was surprised by her suggestion, not that he knew the bigger picture. She must have known the offer could trigger the fraying of the Gobbo illusion. She surely had the foresight to look ahead to calamitous scenarios. She understood the requirements of admissible evidence. She would be examined in a courtroom if her recording of Dale threw up anything incriminating. This moment in the Gobbo story didn't make sense, at least to Solomon, and it still doesn't now. Perhaps Gobbo felt trapped once again. By helping to snare Dale, was she hoping to shrug off the deepening scrutiny of Solomon and other Petra investigators over the past year? Gobbo and Dale had stayed in touch since their relationship, born of fear, paranoia and booze, had first bloomed in 2003. The two of them met at Table 33 at the Avenue Food Store in Albert Park on a dim December day in 2008. Gobbo ordered a large, skinny flat white. The pair talked about the weather, his kids, and her struggle to give up the fags. They both hated shopping, they discovered, in the kind of light chatter that boys cafe custom in Bayside Melbourne. Oh, you've milked the cow, thanks, Gobbo told a waitress after a forgotten coffee was finally delivered. Dale had been the prime suspect in the Hodson killings from the moment the bodies were found. Almost 5 years later, nothing had changed. But he had never been charged, and he has always denied any wrongdoing. It made life tough, he told Gobbo. When he went to Perth to visit a police mate, the mate had sent him away. Dale had lost almost every friendship forged over 17 years as a cop. Gobbo, too, was frustrated. Health worries were still plaguing her. On the recording, she sounds weak and fragile. Her osteoarthritis was sharpened by the Melbourne chill, she told Dale. She was still dosing herself on hillbilly heroin, but she had stopped taking morphine in the mornings. Her facial joint pain exhausted her by early evening, which meant she couldn't be bothered to find a man. She took Botox to ease the pain. As she pointed out, she didn't give a fuck whether it smoothed her wrinkles. Dale was fixated on his coercive examinations at the Australian Crime Commission about Williams's statement against him. The hearings came in waves every few months. Dale, sounding outraged, believed he was being forced to appear at the ACC because of a vendetta headed by Overland. He likened the ACC inquisitions to a title boxing fight. Fucking hell, Gobbo said, sounding sympathetic. Dale told Gobbo how the ACC had played recordings of calls between himself, her, and Williams from early 2004. He talked about Williams's statement to police, fingering Dale for murder. It was the kind of evidence that could get Dale charged, a prospective bridge between long-held theories and verifiable facts. Gobbo flicked the switch from confidant to spy. As far as Petra were concerned, the hour-long chat could be reduced to this critical exchange. Accurate or not, Gobbo asked Dale of the Williams statement. Dale said it was very accurate. Some things that came out that clearly only him and me know. Dale trusted almost no one anymore. His old confidants were scared to be linked with him. But he trusted his old friend Nicola Gobbo. She sounded like she was on his side. She touched on truth when she said, I hope they don't think that I was involved in some murder. Dale's wife, Ditty, arrived with her son, and she and Gobbo exchanged stories about trying to lose weight. Ditty wondered about dressing her baby daughter in pink, and Gobbo spoke of her baby goddaughters. They told exercise tales. I had a personal trainer for a while, but he went to jail, so I have to find a new one. Gobbo explained. The Dales had to go shopping. Anyway, have a wonderful Christmas, Gobbo told them. I hope Santa comes to you. Gobbo rushed back to Cameron Davy and presented the detective with the hidden recorder she had worn. Her breezy chat with Paul Dale would lead directly to his being charged with murder. It would also devastate Gobbo herself. When Overland, Sandy White, and Superintendent Tony Biggin met to discuss Gobbo's status, they decided that Gobbo's value as a witness was more important than the perceived issues regarding her safety. This meeting took place the day before Gobbo had coffee with Dale. It was already decided that looking out for Gobbo's best interests rated second to the desire to jail Paul Dale. In January 2009, a month after wearing the Dale wire, Gobbo was deregistered as an informer so she could appear as a witness at Dale's trial. She was no longer to contact her handlers, but Petra investigators instead. Two Petra detectives were quickly trained up for the role. It's unclear how this was supposed to work. To make this plan succeed, Victoria Police had to cheat the justice system. As an informer, Gobbo's identity could be protected by police, but as a witness, her name could be aired in open court, potentially leading to the exposure of her informer history. All her betrayals and her possibly criminal conspiracy with Victoria Police could be revealed to the world. Her informer number had been changed in early 2008. 3838 became 2958, but a computer-generated designation would not shift human nature. Informer 3838 was a source not only of police intelligence, but also of police gossip. By then, Gobbo's handlers had been considering exit strategies for a year or more. Their notes depict a genuine regard for her safety. For 3 years, she had avoided serious scrutiny over the Hodsons, but Williams's 2007 statement had reframed her usefulness. In approving Gobbo's transition from informer to witness, Overland had said he was aware of the consequences, but that corruption trumps everything. Notes of senior command meetings depicted a bleak certainty. Police protection would be the only way to keep her safe. Yet Gobbo's controller, Sandy White, fought her transition to witness. White didn't think Overland understood that Gobbo's shift in police status jeopardized her life. His fears had been shared by Detective Inspector Gavin Ryan when the question was first raised in 2007. Ryan, who left Victoria Police in early 2008, knew of her informer role. But his Piranha investigators say they did not. An intra-departmental war erupted, with Gobbo as the spoils. Gobbo's handlers feared that her innate eagerness to please could trigger events that revealed her informer past. Do not provide too many clues to Petra, a handler advised her. Her handler's concerns seemed well placed. Now reporting to both SDU and Petra, Gobbo appeared to relish the competing attention. She basked in a fresh audience of curious investigators and continued to inform to both departments for the next 12 months. An SDU information contact report from February 2008 fed the theme that she treated her duplicities as a game. Gobbo makes a point of stating she could never believe that she would be in this position when she began informing 2.5 years ago. Gobbo enjoys the experience and attention of this questioning and the fact that she has extensive knowledge. But Gobbo had no idea then how badly her shift to Petra would go. White and Ryan were right. Overland was wrong. Overland's decision to change Gobbo's status would blast the edifice of the Gobbo illusion. It was the first step towards Gobbo's exposure. No rulebook could have accommodated the seesawing periods of flattery and rejection, submissiveness and ruthlessness that stamped Gobbo's behaviour as informer 3838. She bent the rules of play to satisfy personal intentions that no one had foreseen. Her information reports, all 5,500 produced between 2005 and 2009, offer an intimate insight into her unorthodox thinking and the length to which her handlers went to indulge her. Gobbo was wired to fret, as many successful people are. Her highly strung nature thrived on the strategies of her dangerous game. Yet she was trapped by her unusual dependency. To this day, her handlers claim pride in their management of Gobbo. But when it came to Gobbo, the protocols got tossed out. Her interactions with her handlers lacked any bearings for comparison. She wasn't like any other police spy. Her relationship with them was possibly the closest of her adult life. Part professional, part counselling, and part venom. She gushed, railed, and even got beauty advice. Cucumber eye masks, a handler told her, could be purchased at the body shop. Her handlers received mountains of legally privileged details, which they would later say they did not pass on to investigators. They labelled these gushes of confidential client details as venting. They indulged her demands to scrap speeding tickets and her tax complaints. She rang at all hours and expected to be heard. She raged when a handler was tending to a sick child and couldn't take her call. In her mind, her assistance trumped some kid in hospital. As one handler now says, sounding weary, "We had a job to go milk the cow. When it got mastitis, we rubbed it." Now she was cast adrift. The woman who had wanted to be the best informer ever, the source who put away drug barons and murderers, had been excised like a cancer from Victoria Police's informer roster. After risking so much? Sol Solomon had worked with Paul Dale on the Lorimer Task Force, which had investigated the shooting of police officers Gary Silk and Rod Miller a decade earlier. They used a carpool to and from work. Now Solomon had enough evidence to charge his former colleague with murder. He labelled Gobbo's recording of Dale a breakthrough. Dale appeared to have implicated himself in the Hodson deaths. Dale was charged on the 13th of February 2009 during the numbing grief following Black Saturday, the unprecedented Victorian bushfires that killed 173 people and led to a royal commission that queried police leadership during the emergency. Dale was placed in solitary confinement. In refusing him bail, Justice Marilyn Warren found that he posed an unacceptable risk of interfering with witnesses. The witnesses included Gobbo. Solomon would later say that when Gobbo was asked about testifying against Dale in January 2009, she appeared to be totally committed to the cause. He gave her a welfare check the following month, and she raised no concerns. She was considering going into hiding, and Solomon observed little trepidation on her part. She, of course, might offer an alternative view. Gobbo was listed as Witness F for the murder trial, that is, her identity was not to be revealed. It's a reasonable assumption that Gobbo demanded anonymity in return for giving evidence, but suppressing her name meant a hearing in the Supreme Court. On the 4th of March 2009, Dale's solicitor Tony Hargraves was present when the court heard arguments about shielding Gobbo's identity. Hargraves, who had known Gobbo for years, was rocked by the revelation that she had worn a wire. Returning to his office, he walked past Gobbo having a cigarette at Wheat. He wanted to say something, but wisely chose not to. Dale was told the next day when his lawyers visited him in Barwon Prison. He was incensed. He claimed that Gobbo had broken the cardinal rule of lawyer-client privilege. She always argued that privilege did not apply, except on the very few occasions she officially gave him professional advice, such as the time in December 2004 when she had visited him in remand after he had been charged with burglary. Never mind that she breached the privilege on these occasions anyway. Dale's belief in the confidentiality of their cafe chat was not entirely misplaced. During their discussion, Dale had expressed fears that police might overhear his gripes about the secret ACC hearings, to which Gobbo had replied, "At least you can use the excuse of my being a lawyer." News of Gobbo's wire-wearing was spreading fast. Although the name suppression hearing had taken place in a closed court, the story was too juicy to be kept a secret. The wider legal fraternity was shocked when Witness F was identified as Gobbo. Her penchant for playing outside the accepted codes of behaviour was finally being leaked. Gobbo's professional reputation had long ago been dented by her choice of company. Her name could have been destroyed by any one of her hundreds of unethical choices over the years. Yet it was this single act, which she presented as a noble choice about helping the victims of a murder, that scuttled any hope of a bright legal future. Dale's then barrister, Ian Hill QC, worked out of Crockett Chambers. Gobbo was evicted from the chambers within 24 hours of the suppression hearing. An emergency meeting that included two of Melbourne's most eminent barristers, Robert Richter and Phil Dunn QCs, raised issues concerning the safety of office staff because of Gobbo's clientele. Gobbo's office had been next to Konheliotis QCs and across the hall from Richter's. Her tenancy was mired in suspicion and disdain. The Crockett barristers feared her tarnish. She was far too close to the clients, one of the QCs at Crockett says. She was mixing in too much with them. Paranoia seeped from Gobbo. Many women instinctively flinched from her practice lines in melodrama and victimhood. Male colleagues, conversely, sometimes seemed slow to read the kind of wiles that women can identify in other women. At an office birthday party, Gobbo spoke of being set up with a man who said he was a carpenter, but whom she suspected of being an undercover cop. The decision to evict her had been urged by the wives of the leading barristers. These women were scandalised by Gobbo's tales of public promiscuity. Many solicitors had stopped briefing her as a barrister. They could no longer trust her. A foreboding deepened by suspicions that she recorded conversations with other Crockett lawyers. How this concern was first raised, or if there is any evidence for it, is unknown. Yet the implications are, as one of the affected QCs says, mind-blowing. Was Gobbo recording private conversations about legal strategies pertaining to high-profile cases? Was she passing this intelligence on to police? Had police asked her to record such conversations? If so, dozens of cases that did not even involve her stand to be queried. Philip Dunn, QC, is one who believes the rumours, as does another Crockett QC. "I reckon she did compromise cases," that QC recently said. "It's bloody appalling, isn't it? It's a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice with the coppers who were handling her." The revelation, according to police notes, about Gobbo's possible snooping in Sharon Cure's office in mid-2007 would not emerge until a dozen years later. How many lawyers moonlight as cat burglars on the weekend? In the press conference room at the Victoria Police Centre in Flinders Street, Simon Overland was holding a meet-and-greet with journalists, including Darsley, following his appointment on the 2nd of March 2009 as Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police. That venue has hosted many shock announcements, but today's was unprecedented. Overland told the media he was aware that many journalists had contacts within the force. Of course they did. Police officers help journalists for a variety of motives, mainly to solve crimes or ease injustice. Now, however, he was determined to stop leaks. From now on, any police officer found speaking to the media outside prescribed controls would be prosecuted for a crime. The message jarred. Overland was supposed to represent freshness and transparency. How did this tally with prosecuting officers who unofficially chatted to journalists? The meet and greet was a harbinger. Overland's command culture would be buried in internal suspicion. Assistant Commissioner Noel Ashby was one of many senior police, including Deputy Commissioner Sir Ken Jones, to have his phone tapped over obscure media leak allegations during Overland's time in the top job. Ashby remains livid that the Office of Police Integrity, OPI, also tapped the phone of his 16-year-old daughter. He calls the OPI Overland's private investigation agency and has labelled Overland, OPI head Graham Ashton and Assistant Commissioner Luke Cornelius, the three amigos. The trio knew each other from the Australian Federal Police and had imported the AFP's investigative techniques of surveillance, phone taps and listening devices. Ashby has the righteous quality of the wronged. His police heritage is easy to spot as he hurries down Swan Street, Richmond, on a cold winter's day after coffee with Dowsley and Carlyon, the straight bearing, the briefcase, the long coat. He tried, without success, to get hold of the affidavit that had led to the tap on his phone. At the time, he says, he boasted an unblemished 35-year record. More than 50 of the phone tappings instigated by Overland related to the vexed Briars investigation into the 2003 death of the so-called vampire gigolo, Shane Chartres Abbott. The male prostitute, who claimed to drink blood, was accused of raping a woman and biting off her tongue. He was thought to have been killed by Jack Price as revenge for his attack on the woman, an exotic dancer. Price set off police interest when he wrote vampire on his hand during a jailhouse meeting with a police officer. Police came to believe the hit was carried out as a favour to the woman's boyfriend, Mark Perry. Price, serving a lengthy sentence for three underworld murders, was the pin-up boy of the Deal or No Deal unit. As already stated, he had cooperated with police on many gangland crimes in exchange for reduced jail time, and his information was often unreliable. In March 2007, Task Force Briars was set up to investigate Price's claims concerning Detective Sergeant Peter Stash Laylor. Price told police that Laylor had given him the address of Chartres Abbott. He claimed that a former detective sergeant, David Waters, a drinking pal, also had prior knowledge of the hit. Waters and Laylor were the targets of a massive anti-corruption operation featuring multiple leaks and phone taps, including the one Ashby was subjected to. But Briars became a $30 million waste of time. The operation exploded into newspaper headlines and withered under widespread examination. Briars shared many elements with Petra. Both were run with the assistance of the Office of Police Integrity. Both were triggered by the claims of known liars and murderers looking for a deal. Liars can sometimes tell the truth, certainly, but both Petra and Briars failed to snare their intended targets. The intricacies of Briars defy easy explanation. In essence, the public was intrigued by a supposed nexus between dirty cops and underworld heavies, and police brass, including Overland, and then Chief Commissioner Nixon, was sensitive to these impressions. The secret ops preoccupation that characterised Briars was the same acutely political, if not paranoid, approach that had allowed a source of intelligence like Gobbo to flourish. A grand police hypocrisy shouldn't be overlooked. Under Overland's guidance, Briars deteriorated into a fever of petty hatreds that had little to do with solving a murder. But such onerous levels of scrutiny were never supposed to apply to Overland and his subordinates in their use of secret agent Gobbo. As a witness in the Dale murder case, Gobbo was more valuable than ever. She had lost her professional reputation and her legal career seemed doomed. Dale knew she had cheated him, and most of the underworld was wondering if they, too, were victims of Gobbo's deceit. Perhaps most importantly, Gobbo had lost her handlers, who had offered her understanding. By the start of 2009, she needed a holiday after a frenzy of death threats and double dealing. A police detail tagged along with her everywhere she went, to Queensland and Bali as well, on trips funded by the Victorian taxpayer, who also paid for her Victoria Racing Club membership and the pink concert tickets she had to forego for safety reasons. One officer, she later told Dowsley, got so drunk in Bali that she had to help carry him home. Another had a phobia about germs. She didn't feel very protected. Her police entourage seemed incapable of looking after itself. Petra paid $193,000 to protect her during this limbo of uncertainty. There were 35 flights in 10 months. The figures suggest that Gobbo flew business class. She was getting a $1,000 weekly stipend. The police service came to a total price tag of $304,642, including the payment of a $113 parking fine. Despite this taxpayer bill of $30,000 odd a month, Gobbo's lifestyle and prestige were gone. For 2 weeks, on and off, in June 2009, she was provided with 24-hour guard by a crack team of officers from the Elite Special Operations Group, presumably after another threat was made against her. She was supposed to get permission before calling any clients or associates. She jumped on one plane after another under a false name to minimize the risks. Gobbo was right. This was no life. Deputy Commissioner Kieran Walsh wrote to her about her necessary inclusion in witness protection on the 4th of June 2009. He spoke of very serious threats against you, the major risks you now face, and how, to date, you have refused to enter the program. In August 2009, Gobbo was admitted to hospital in Melbourne for 17 days, for various conditions aggravated by stress. Detective Sergeant Sol Solomon was shocked by her appearance and mental state when he visited her soon after her admission. He encouraged her to eat some mashed potato. Physically, she was thin, pale, and had lesions over her body, he would say. Mentally, she was depressed and stressed. We tried to take her to dinner, but she wouldn't eat. Gobbo regretted her involvement with the police, she told Solomon. Notions of betrayal festered as the implications of being a witness grew clearer. She had given so much, and now she felt burned in return. She had contemplated police protection in the past, but the necessity of a new identity and the loss of the old had sharpened. Gobbo was proud of her surname. She didn't want to surrender it. But she had no power to barter, not like this. Her rhetoric harks back to Melvin Udall, the malcontent in the 1997 movie As Good As It Gets, who spoke of being evicted from his own life. Promises had been broken. At times, Solomon would say Gobbo was deranged with anger. He tried to counsel her, but she said he didn't understand. If only he knew the truth, she told him. While Gobbo holidayed in Bali with a police entourage in May 2009, Detective Senior Sergeant Ron Iddles was given what sounded like a cushy assignment. Iddles had hunted countless killers over a lauded career in homicide and was known for his Bradman-like conviction rate. Now, at short notice, he was to find his passport and go to Bali with his superior, Detective Inspector Steve Waddell. Overland had issued an order. The two detectives were to hunker down in a luxury hotel and take a witness statement relating to the murder of Shane Charteris Abbott. On discovering that Gobbo was the witness, Iddles made sense of the secrecy and rush that had enveloped the trip. He already knew of her informing, and he was aware her life was in extreme peril. But he did not grasp the depth of her assistance to police. Gobbo had represented David Waters, one of the two officers accused of links to the Charteris Abbott murder, in 2004 and 2007, when Waters had been charged with and acquitted of drug offences. She had since played her customary role of pretending to be a lawyer to disguise being a police agent. She'd fronted police stings that had sought to expose the detective's alleged involvement in the murder. She'd furnished police with reports of Waters's goings-on. On police orders, she'd tried to pin down Waters with questions about Charteris Abbott. It wasn't her best undercover work. Waters now says he was struck by her odd questions, as if she were trying to extract incriminating information from him. Taking her witness statement, Edels found Gobbo hard work. Informers often are, given that their information is normally negotiated or induced. She seemed happy enough to volunteer the material, yet her statement took 2.5 days in a room at the Hard Rock Hotel due to the constant breaks for cigarettes by the pool. In Idles's view, Gobbo's unsigned statement contained little evidentiary value. But this was not his biggest concern. It was the other things she revealed that worried him. Over the course of those 2.5 days, she helped him grasp the improbable. "I crossed the line a long time ago. I've been acting in the interests of Victoria Police, not my clients." Idles judged Gobbo to be very intelligent and naive, a description he also applied to the police commanders who had pressed for her statement. Idles and Waddell got the statement. Then, with an old-world wisdom that eluded some officers, Idles refused to let her sign it. He told her she would be signing her death warrant. Gobbo says that Idles warned her senior command would burn her. Idles also wondered at the fallout if she were to confront a thorough barrister under cross-examination. Two words kept flashing in his mind: Royal Commission. Idles relayed his concerns to Overland. "You will get it signed," he was told. "But I didn't," Idles now says. The full extent of Gobbo's work as a police agent was not known to Idles until he sat down with her in Bali in 2009. When her unsigned statement was presented to the Royal Commission in 2019, it contained a sensational confession claim that Idles says he had never heard. Mark Perry, the key target of the Briars investigation, was said to have confessed to Gobbo, a lawyer he did not know, that he had ordered the killing of Charteris Abbott. The conversation purportedly took place in the office of Perry's solicitor, James Vallos, while Vallos was taking a phone call. Gobbo and Idles had no recollection of the confession claim. Did it ever happen? Waddell testified in 2019 that it did. Idles and Gobbo said it did not. It seems remarkable that an alleged confession by a suspected killer was never used in evidence against him. Then again, it was Nicola Gobbo who said she heard the confession, and to this day, no one knows whether it was made or not. There were further tangles in the Briars Task Force debacle. During Perry's 2014 trial for ordering the hit on Charteris Abbott, Jack Price said that Gobbo had visited him in prison in 2006. He said that his conversation with Gobbo helped lead him to confess to killing Charteris Abbott. Paul Dale was granted bail in September 2009, after 8 months in the Acacia unit at Barwon Prison, mixing with the most feared murder and terrorism suspects in the state. He says that when he chatted with Tony Mockbell in an adjoining cell, Mockbell was stunned to hear that Gobbo had worn a wire to incriminate Dale. Chief Prosecutor Gavin Silbert SC had objected to Dale's bail. To put it crudely, organising an execution has to be more difficult from prison than outside. The execution Silbert was referring to was Gobbo's. She was still unwilling to receive police protection. Deputy Commissioner Walsh switched focus. He wrote on the 26th of August 2009 to tell Gobbo that ad hoc security arrangements represent an unacceptable security risk to the health and safety of the police officers who have been protecting you. This was an interesting strategy. Gobbo had refused police protection, in part because she did not trust the police. In response, Walsh claimed that protecting Gobbo was too dangerous for the police. By November 2009, there was fierce agreement on one point. Gobbo was struggling. Since 2004, she had had jaw, heart, neck, breast, ulcer, and cyst surgeries, and suffered dramatic weight loss. Her figure was drastically thinner than it once was. Svelte, in a little black dress and heels at a 2008 funeral, she projected a glamour that had previously eluded her. She had shed the fleshiness that had once led Mandy Hodson to nickname her Sharon 20 Stone. The line of her jaw was slimmer, though photos also depict her features as tightened with tension. She feared cancer. Understandably, given the shedding of kilos and a possible genetic predisposition, the disease had already struck her father. She would be forced to confront that fear soon enough. It's thought to be in Brisbane, during one of her 2009 trips to Queensland, that she called a police officer from the top of a building. She had had enough. She brimmed with pique, scorn, and self-defeating rage. The tone of her text messages at the time, reported later in this book, hint that anger was winning the battle against depression and ill health. Perhaps she was simply seeking attention. "I'm going to jump," she screamed to the officer on the other end of the phone.